Welcome to Asset Finance Connect's series of podcasts on the European asset finance industry. I'm Richard O'Donoghue, and for the past few months, I've been chatting to industry experts about the challenges and opportunities facing our industry in 2025 and beyond. As we move into the final few months of the year, we'll continue to explore many of the topics that we discussed in earlier podcasts, such as AI, sustainability, and captives. We'll also introduce some new topics and get different perspectives from people that may be less well known in the European asset finance industry. As always, thanks to our sponsors Alpha for their continued support, and we'll tell you a little bit more about them later in this podcast. So something we've tried to do in our series of podcasts is introduce companies or topics that are perhaps less well known to the European asset finance industry. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Bo White, who is the Head of Corporate Development at LIT. LIT, Bo, is probably not a company a lot of people have heard, but we're delighted to have you here today. I know you're in Geneva in Switzerland today, but you're normally based in Seattle, I believe.
That's correct. Yes. And thank you for having me on the show. I'm very excited to have the discussion with you all.
Great. And you've got a very interesting backstory, and I'd like to get to that a little bit later because I think our listeners will be fascinated by maybe your early career, but let's talk a little bit about more maybe your more recent career and how this links into LIT. So maybe give the listeners a little bit of background.
Sure. So I started my career in asset finance and leasing at a small boutique business called Century Financial. It's based in Salt Lake City. And they were focused on highly structured, bespoke vendor finance deals. I'm working with a range of major OEMs, system integrators, and really quite globally. And that's where I cut my teeth, learned a tremendous amount from the CEO and the COO within that business. We did everything in-house, everything from term sheets, the legal, the financial modeling, the credit underwriting. We were really a lean and mean machine and really became quite passionate about the business while I was there. Ultimately moved over to Macquarie and helped set up the Macquarie Asset Finance business as it was coming back into the U.S. market after having sold their prior business to Huntington Technology Finance. And worked very closely with a range of different groups within Macquarie, but I was heavily focused on the digital infrastructure side of Macquarie specialized in asset finance business and specifically the telecommunications industry. So we were really riding the wave of everything that was going on with the carriers' investment into 4G and 5G equipment, all the sort of new core infrastructure that was being built out, and finding kind of bespoke solutions to help carriers globally acquire and finance that technology. And within that context, we were looking at a lot of the different trends and let's call it themes that were impacting our industry. And one of the key ones was the impact of the lease accounting rules changing under IFRS and US GAAP in 2019. And so we spent a lot of time thinking through how do we approach this sort of new paradigm, if you will? How do we get into the as a service market? Because we saw that as being a kind of critical new market that we needed to understand. A lot of different trends actually pushing us that way, not just the accounting rules. There's a lot of other dynamics that we can get into later. And I became very, very passionate about that space. And that's how I learned about LIT. And so after having incubated the business a bit while I was at Macquarie, ultimately decided to get out from behind the mahogany desks of the bank and into the trenches, if you will, of a sort of scrappy earlier stage startup.
And if you believe all the stories you hear in Australia about Macquarie pay packages, they probably do have mahogany desks, at least in the Sydney office. But tell us a little bit then about LIT and why was it set up? And in particular, you talked about transformation, different business models. What sort of customer needs was LIT looking to address?
Sure. So LIT was really, it started as a kind of bespoke financial widget, if you will, okay, that had found a creative way to provide asset financing that met the IFRS and US GAAP requirements for true as a service contracts and in a, let's call it bankable way, right? In a way that could be digested within the capital markets, within the risk frameworks that both regulated and unregulated asset financiers could consume. And so the business really started doing one-off transactions, if you will, with some of the larger OEMs in the technology space, and then also with what we call the global system integrators. So these large integrators that deal with Fortune 1000 clients and need sort of bespoke asset financing solutions for them. After having done a few of those transactions, you know, we really came to the conclusion that the business needed two things beyond the accounting component to really scale into that market. One was systems, investment into a real platform for managing the deployment of assets at scale and being able to know exactly when assets were ordered, delivered, and accepted within a platform and getting out of sort of emails and spreadsheets that is endemic to the asset finance industry. And then the second is really having a global platform. So in the ecosystem that we work in, our partners are dealing with large Fortune 1000 clients that are typically multinationals, and they want a sort of ubiquitous solution that covers them in all the countries that they might operate in. And so we had to build out a framework of entities, banking infrastructure, et cetera, that allows us to provide asset financing in a consistent contractual model. And today we think we can do this in over 50 countries, and we have entities in about 35 countries. So that was a big shift in our business model. And has really become the main differentiator for our business today.
And just maybe talk a little bit about the platform, because, you know, particularly in Europe, there are a number of companies that have asset tracking capabilities and reasonably sophisticated asset tracking capabilities. Does your platform go beyond that?
It does, yes. So there's a couple of components to it, but the first is our ability to integrate with our go-to-market partners, if you will. They have systems in place that they use to manage the assets that they have been deploying or managing on behalf of their clients. And our platform integrates extremely well with theirs. Their client can have an employee in Dublin who's ordering a device, and we know when that device was ordered. We know exactly when we need to place the order with the OEM. We know when the asset has been shipped. We know where it is, and then ultimately when it's been delivered, accepted, and when that asset has been associated with a specific individual or a specific cost center, all the way down to the serial number level. And that platform is ubiquitous. We can do this everywhere in the world. And having that single point of truth and that single platform that allows the end customer, our go-to-market partner, and our asset financing partners, the banks that we work with, being able to know that entire chain is quite powerful. And there's a bunch of analytics that we can run on top of this as well. Portfolio analytics, we can provide a range of different dashboard views for the different partners that we have. If it's a banking partner, they're going to have specific, you know, information they're looking for around acceptance and the tenor of the specific asset, which might be very different than the end customer who's really just trying to optimize the overall portfolio and thinking through a range of dynamics on performance of the assets and potentially refreshes, et cetera. So yeah, those are sort of the high level dynamics, if you will, of the platform.
That's great. And I think you kind of have touched on it a little bit, the way you work with the global systems integrators, but maybe talk about a typical customer use case.
Sure. So when you think about these large multinational corporations, they're constantly thinking through how can they optimize their on-premise infrastructure. They often go to the, let's call it, global system integrators of the world for advice, both on the design of, could be a hybrid cloud infrastructure, it could be end-user compute like a laptop deployment or all the peripherals that might sit around the end user compute, or, you know, fixed wireless access, or, you know, a range of different asset classes. We're agnostic, okay? But they'll go to these global system integrators to help them design that solution. But increasingly, those end customers want their global system integrator partner to not only provide them with advice and consulting, but they want them to be able to manage the solution as well and align that advice with the performance of the solution. And that's really where we come into play, because generally speaking, global system integrators, other service providers, they don't want to put these assets on their balance sheet. They don't want to manage all the OEM warranties and all the nitty-gritties of deploying the assets. They want to design it, they want to manage it, but not specifically on the asset side. And so we will receive a bill of materials from our global system integrator. We'll fund against that. And we can do it in a way that's really well aligned to their commercial business model, where they have consistent T's and C's globally. We're not breaking apart the contract and having separate terms and conditions for different countries. And it really allows them to have a low friction end-to-end managed service solution for their end customer.
And I guess the attraction, as you say, to them is it's a consistent global solution in over 50 countries, and you've put the effort in to establish entities in 30 plus countries.
Correct. Yes. It's quite difficult to build that out, to be honest, and to be able to manage all the tax and regulatory compliance and property use considerations and the ability to bill and collect locally in local currency and manage all the FX considerations as well is quite an undertaking. But it dramatically reduces the operational burden for our go-to-market partners and also for our banking partners that we partner with. It allows them to provide their capital and access to a market that they wouldn't otherwise be able to, both within the sort of as-a-service, true IFRS US GAAP compliant as-a-service market, as well as sort of expanding their geographic footprint, whilst also maintaining the risk management framework that they're used to.
And without revealing anything proprietary, I mean, how challenging is it to kind of achieve off-balance sheet status, both for, I guess, the global systems integrator and the end user customer?
Yeah, so when you think about as a service, well, first of all, that term is thrown out so often within the asset finance market, no one really knows what it means anymore. Okay, so it's worth us.
I'm not sure people knew what it meant at the beginning, let alone anymore.
So what one of the big tension between true as a service and traditional asset financing or leasing is what to do with the traditional hell or high water payment obligation. Okay, because asset financiers want to be decoupled from any performance risk, and they want a clean payment stream that is due to them irrespective of the performance of the solution, both on the technology side and on the services side. Okay. When you have that hell or high water language, you will trip the lease accounting rules. It becomes a lease, whether it's embedded within a service contract or it's a standalone lease documentation. So within our commercial framework, we allow for termination for convenience and termination for cause in our contract. Now, when you go talk to a credit committee or an underwriting committee at a bank about termination for convenience, termination for cause, it sucks up all the oxygen out of the room and they ask you to move on, right? Mm-hmm. And so we found a really creative way that helps them meet their traditional risk criteria and allows for our contracts which have those risks embedded within it to be consumed by the most traditional and sort of risk averse banks of the world even. Okay. And we do that through insurance. So one of our founders is an insurance guru, and he really came to the conclusion that, you know, termination for cause and termination for convenience is a probability of an event occurring. Okay. And the insurance markets are very accustomed to underwriting that type of risk. And frankly, they've been underwriting that type of risk in these types of projects for many, many years, particularly in the project finance industry, which is, you know, a area of practice that Macquarie is very, very sophisticated in. So we really were borrowing some basic risk management principles from project finance and then applying it into the sort of leasing or asset finance market to cover ourselves for that termination for cause and termination for convenience risk.
And I know I'm going to get listeners sending me comments saying, you're completely wrong. But my view, and having spoken to a couple of people in the industry, is this is pretty unique. I mean, you know, I know when I was at Dell or at other companies, we grappled with that termination for convenience position and, you know, how would we manage that risk, albeit it's a remote risk. And I think the kind of solution you have with insurance is a really interesting solution that I haven't seen in the market before. So I think it's something our listeners, as I say, they may criticize me and say, of course we use it, but certainly I haven't seen it in the past.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes the asset finance market is using credit insurance to move deals along. And that's obviously very common in the supply chain finance and distribution finance markets as well. But this is really, you know, covering for performance risk. And while it is innovative and new in the asset finance and leasing marketplace. It is, you know, steak and potatoes in other pockets of finance, specifically in project finance. So we're really just taking risk management tools that are well established and applying it into a marketplace that frankly needs to innovate.
And look, I think I've said before, I think project finance is a great place for us to look towards because it's all about allocating risks to the parties that are best positioned to take those risks. And I think that's what you've done within your contractual framework. You've taken out certain risks that a funder doesn't want to take, and you found a way to make them comfortable with those risks.
And now a word from our sponsors. Alpha Systems is the class-leading SaaS platform for equipment and auto finance. With modules for usage-based billing, the asset lifecycle, and revolving credit facilities, Alpha Systems is built to support as-a-service models. Alpha Systems helps you manage complex portfolios, drive efficiency, and enhance the customer experience. If you're ready to simplify your operations, visit alphasystems.com to learn more. That's ALFASystems.com.
I just want to touch on something else, which is you're a very lean company, LIT. It's not a huge company by any manner or means. So how do you source these opportunities?
Sure. So we work very closely with go-to-market partners that are operating in, and again, this sort of global technology ecosystem. And we don't get involved typically with their end customer negotiations. We leave that completely up to them. But we listen very closely to the friction points that they've had with the more traditional leasing companies of the world. And we've created a contractual framework and really an operating model that takes out a lot of that friction. You know, I mentioned some of the points earlier around, you know, consistent T's and C's globally, around having a platform that integrates into their go-to-market model. You know, having that global footprint where they can bill and collect locally, et cetera. Okay. And so we really are working with them as a go-to-market partner where they own the end customer relationship. They are the one that's originating the opportunity. And then we're helping them be successful and being able to bring a differentiated managed service solution to those clients so that they can scale that business. And we also partner with OEMs as well, both where they're providing a solution directly to end customers, but also where they're selling into managed service providers and their sort of channel ecosystem. And then also with the banks as well. So, you know, one of the areas that we're starting to explore more now is really working with banks that have their own vendor partner relationships. And how can we just help the bank serve their own vendor partner ecosystem better through leveraging our platform, through leveraging our global footprint, and improving and differentiating their dynamic with their own vendors.
And I know you're in Europe this week to meet with a number of those banks and your insurers and some of the global systems integrators. I mean, just generally talk to me a little bit about partnerships and opportunities perhaps for some of our listeners, most of whom will be in the asset finance industry, to collaborate with LIT.
Sure. So look, I mean, we really view ourselves as an orchestrator. We built a platform that enables our partners, which generally speaking, you know, consist of global system integrators / managed service providers, those who are sort of designing and implementing an integrated kit or solution for an end customer, the OEMs themselves, and then the capital markets ecosystem, right? We're a small company. We don't have our own sort of funding at scale, if you will, to take down large transactions. We fundamentally have to partner with the capital markets, okay? And so we really look to partner at each one of those layers and convert these as-a-service transactions in a way that each of those groups can consume and implement in a way that is low friction for them and is as close as possible to their risk framework or their overall commercial framework so that they can really access this market in a more efficient and more sort of interesting and differentiated way.
Right. Well, look, interesting business model. I don't want to say disruptive business model because it's actually a business model that I think allows for collaboration with maybe more traditional asset finance companies. And it's more about how do they find those opportunities to collaborate with you. And I'm sure some of them will reach out to you in due course and probably meet with you perhaps on your next visit to Europe. But I did at the beginning kind of allude to the fact that you had an interesting backstory and an early career. And We had a podcast recently with Bjorn van der Berg from Sandvik, and he started his career in the military, which, again, a lot of people were very interested in. And you started your career in a slightly different area, and maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that, and also how those experiences perhaps shaped your business career, if I want to differentiate between the two.
No, that's great. I appreciate you asking. So look, I spent my early career working in international development, too, something I was very, very passionate about. And I focused specifically on post-conflict and what is generally known in the industry as least developed countries. So those countries that kind of fall from a development standpoint, and let's call it the bottom, you know, third of the major indices that are used to sort of qualify that. And I was extremely passionate about working in these places, including, you know, Bosnia, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Papua New Guinea, in a range of, let's call it, traditionally off-piste type countries. And through those experiences, I really saw how project finance and specifically different types of infrastructure projects, when done properly, could make massive positive impacts on these countries, whether that was within telecommunications or within water, roads, sort of core infrastructure, if you will. And that really created the base for economic prosperity in a lot of these countries. And I also came to realize that space was frankly best served by the private markets. And, you know, with certain incentives from development agencies and what have you, but really started to shift my career, if you will, more towards, you know, the private markets as opposed to working within organizations like the United Nations or NGOs and whatnot. And, you know, in a way, I still try to maintain that spirit with LIT. So a couple of interesting features that I think still align with those early days of my career is, one, you know, we're a very global business. We have assets, you know, throughout Latin America, you know, even in Pakistan, in Egypt, you know, India, various pockets in Asia Pacific. And then obviously our core footings are in Europe and in the US. But, you know, that sort of international flavor and being able to facilitate economic growth on these markets is something that's I'm very passionate about, if you will. You know, two is, you know, just the makeup of our team here at LIT. We have a lot of first generation Americans, primarily from Latin America. And this is the American dream for them, right? To, you know, build a business, to scale it, you know, and they're just, you know, some of the smartest, most dedicated lawyers, engineers, financiers, et cetera, that, you know, for one reason or another, made it to the United States via, you know, Venezuela, Colombia, Mexico, Peru, et cetera. And that culture of multilingual sort of international perspectives is something that helps differentiate us with our partners, because again, they're very, very international partners. And sort of having that flavor of worldly experience is something that I find quite fun. And I'm the least interesting of the lit team, by the way. I have the most vanilla background ever, but very much appreciate the background that our team has.
Your family does have a European background, though, for our listeners.
That's correct. So on my father's side, sort of old Quaker stock that came over to the United States, you know, very, very early in the sort of, you know, explorer stages, if you will, of the United States. And then on my mother's side, primarily from Ukraine and Poland, and they came over to the United States really between World War I and World War II, when they heard that the U.S. government was giving free land away. And they ended up in the depending on how you look at it, fortunate or unfortunate region of North Dakota, which is absolutely beautiful and where my good portion of my family still is. But it's difficult country and difficult land to manage up there.
You know, what I think is nice as you kind of tell that background and the background of the people from LIT is it's very easy in Europe for us to read the media and think, you know, the US has completely changed. And, you know, what sort of made America great over the last 50 years or 60 years or 70 years, actually, with its success, that it's being undermined. And I think the reality is probably slightly different on the ground. I was in the US a few weeks ago. And again, you know, it wasn't at least from a feeling point of view, it didn't seem that different to what it had been when I would have visited 2-3 years ago. And I think it's encouraging to kind of get your perspective that, you know, despite all of the noise, let's call it that, it hasn't really fundamentally changed or doesn't appear to be fundamentally changing.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, one of the things I love about America is that we always have had a really strong political discourse. You know, people want to share their ideas, their views, they want to have those conversations. And because we are such a diverse nation, you're naturally going to get a lot of views and a lot of perspectives. You know, one of the things that concerns me and frankly has concerned me for, you know, a long time is how social media has sort of created divisions within that discourse, where you end up with these kind of echo chambers. No matter what side of the bench your political sort of leanings are, it creates these echo chambers where folks tend to talk about the ideas that resonate with them with other people who have the same viewpoints. And I would love to see social media allowing us to create more of that sort of traditional engagement where folks from both sides of the bench are having more constructive dialogues around how we're going to shape our future, how we're going to shape our society, education, economics, et cetera. And that is where I hope our country can ultimately get to, right? Where we can use these tools to go back to our roots of strong civic engagement and respect. And yeah, that's the dream, if you will.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we get back to that and appreciate your views on it. Finally, are we going to see more of you in Europe? Is Europe a big market for you?
Absolutely. Europe is a big market for us, you know, for a range of reasons. One is a lot of our partners have strong footings here, and we've found them to be some of our most creative, most flexible partners. And two is, you know, despite sort of the sort of standardization within the European Union, et cetera, there's still a lot of unique aspects that need to be managed within every single country. So if you have a large multinational corporation that has footings throughout Europe, you know, we're a very good solution because we create a lot of consistency for those rollouts. And similarly, a lot of the specific individuals that work within our OEM and global system integrator community that deal with regions in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia Pacific, are concentrated here in Europe. And so they just have a very global mindset, which aligns well with what we're doing and sort of where we're differentiated.
Well, look, thanks for taking time out this morning from your schedule. And I wish you a successful trip around Europe. And maybe we'll see you at Asset Finance Connect's next European event. So, Bo, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for the time.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Asset Finance Connect, sponsored by Alpha. I first came across Bo and LIT earlier this year and was really impressed with the solution they had developed. As Bo mentioned, LIT started off with a financial solution that was designed to address the accounting requirements of large enterprises and systems integrators. However, they quickly enhanced their offering by building a platform that allows these systems integrators to deliver as-a-service solutions on a globally consistent basis. I was also intrigued by the way in which LIT has leveraged insurance to make it easier to fund these deals, particularly when it comes to termination for convenience risk. For me, the LIT story is a great example of how relatively small companies can pivot quickly into new areas and bring innovative new solutions to market. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'll have more episodes in the months ahead, so look out for those. And as always, we welcome suggestions for future topics that you would like us to cover. Thanks for listening.